Good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. When Mo called me Nathan, it's not actually incorrect. Fun fact, Taylor's my middle name. It's what my parents decided I would go by, but Nathan's my legal first name. So if you saw, maybe Mo knew that. Yeah, he saw my driver's license. I don't know what he was doing in my wallet, but that's a different... That's a different question. Great to be with all of you this morning. We've been talking about barriers that we encounter most frequently in our faith, and so we're going to continue that this morning by talking about, I think, what is probably one of the greatest barriers when it comes to sharing our faith, and that is fear. And as Mo mentioned, I'm going to try to make this kind of a class. And I'll ask some questions and ask for your feedback as we go. We'll see how that goes. And if you have any questions, you're welcome to ask them. If this goes the way that I hope it will, I'll try to work all the way up until a quarter till so that we run out of time for questions so that you can't ask anything. No, if you do have any comments, this is a great text that we're going to look at in Mark chapter 5. And I'm sure that you all have really valuable insights and things to add or questions to ask. So at any point in the way, feel free to get my attention, raise your hand, and let me know if you want to add anything. Mark chapter 5, go ahead and open your Bibles there, and we're going to look at an incident that Jesus, that plays out in the life of, and ministry of Jesus. Where he heals a man who is possessed by a legion of demons. Most people know this man as the Gerasene demoniac, and so we'll talk about Jesus and the outcast this morning. What I want to start, though, with is just a question for you all to think about and jump in on. When you think about the things that make you most afraid to share your faith with people, what are some of those? Like, if you're comfortable sharing that and you don't feel obligated, but what are some of the things that make you the most nervous or insecure or just most uncomfortable when it comes to trying to talk to somebody else about Jesus, about the Bible? What are some of those things for you all? I'll just start, and maybe this will kick it off. I'm a people pleaser just by nature. It's kind of the way that I'm wired. And so one of the things that really, especially early on, that always was difficult for me is the possibility that somebody would say, no, I don't really want to talk about this. And that was just a hard thing to think about and to kind of wrestle with. And I guess I've made some sense of that, but that's a big thing. Still is for me. Who else? I saw a hand back here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was going to go along the same lines, but it's not... Not from the perspective of being a people pleaser, but nobody likes to be rejected, and that's what it means.
Good.
So try to avoid that at all costs. That's really tongue-in-cheek, but and I think the other thing is if you have something so valuable, you want to share it, you know, hey, dude, this is like really important, you know, maybe not those words, but it's like, you just listen.
Right. Good. Both very good. Yes, sir, and yes, sir.
Offering it to my authority figures above me.
Okay. Yeah, there's a very real fear that this is going to have some consequence. I mean, there could be some blowback.
Well, it's not that. But I respect their authority, and it's a... it just fits in the category of fear of trespassing on their authority before me.
Okay, good, good. So out of respect for the people that you're talking to. Yeah, very good. Yes, sir.
I think because we want to be accepted, I think the concept of being labeled as either a Jesus freak or a fanatic or whatever, it kind of is like... keeps us from getting out of our shell.
Okay, good. Yeah, and I mean, we've seen over the last few years what happens in cancel culture. That is such a vibrant thing and such a powerful phenomenon in our society that can really weigh on us. Like, I don't want to get canceled by my friends. I want to be able to maintain relationships, not just for the value of the relationship. A lot of times, you know, we love the people that we have relationships with, but we also, we don't want to put all our chips out there at once if we think that maybe that's too risky and I'm better off just kind of waiting and playing a long game. So those are very, very good fears, very valid fears. Others that you think about? Yes, ma'am.
So the young person being bullied.
Yeah, good. And I don't know if it's that off base to say that can even play out for adults. You know, bullying can take different forms, and I think it's probably most keenly felt by younger folks. But even as we grow up, that could be something that weighs on us. Yes, ma'am.
I don't like to talk to acquaintances about it because if they know me at all, I'm not the best example of the Christian. So I figure, I'm not the person to be saying anything.
Okay, yeah. That's a great one, and I think it's a common one. You know, maybe you've felt at some point, or you feel like that in your life right now, that I just feel like I can't talk about this because I'm not where I need to be, and so there's fear that comes from not wanting to be hypocritical, which is a good thing, but sometimes that can silence us. Very good. Yes?
Yeah, to her point, I think it's interesting, because I think when you say you're a Christian, all of a sudden you're being judged. It's really people look at you now completely different. You
got to
be okay with that.
Good, good. So a lot of good things here.
The bar becomes very high.
Yes, I mean, suddenly. It's kind of that idea that Jesus expressed: "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill can't be hidden." We can't hide when people find out we're Christians. But the reality is that's going to be true whether we talk about it or not. You know, if people find out, they're going to expect a certain thing. And so that's just part of, comes with the territory. Any of you, yes, sir.
I just wanted to mention, you mentioned about being normal, the way of people pleasing. It's so easy to lean that way when you're a nice guy. As a Christian, the temptation is to appease people. And one of the things that also, for myself, not being a people pleaser, you want people happier. You want to bring joy to people's lives. And sometimes you can't. The one thing I've realized over the years is you'll never be able to know King of Gospel, no matter how nice of a person they are. The only thing that I think buffers fearing people and what they think, having a fear of the Lord, is what comes to my mind every time I kind of cringe up to even say something to someone is Jesus said, "Whoever is ashamed of me, right mind the Lord is all ashamed of him before my Father."
Good.
And so for me, shame on me if I don't. Woe to me if I don't preach the gospel also. So that all ties in. You always want. You ever walk away and go, "Oh, I should have said that to him, and I did." You know, right. It's such a balance. It really is.
Good.
And there's so much fear, intimidation. You know, to get the right words out to people.
Right. And kind of a variation of that, you know, the desire to say things just right in a certain way is the fear that I just don't know enough or I'm going to say the wrong thing, those sorts of things. But the reality is these are all common. I'll get to the slide here. These are all common things that we wrestle with, and they're all things that Jesus addresses, which is one of the reasons that this encounter especially, I think, is super instructive for us. What I want to do, we're going to read here in the text here in just a little bit. I want to look at this from two perspectives, and both of these perspectives tie into overcoming how we overcome fear. One is learning from Jesus' method just to be better evangelists. One of the ways we overcome fear is just through knowledge. We learn more, we learn how to maneuver in situations better. And so we're going to learn some things from Jesus' method that can help us. But the other thing we're going to focus on, the other perspective, is I want to see from the perspective of the man who has the legion, just how much Jesus valued him. Because I think the other thing that helps us overcome fear, you know, somebody can know a lot and still be afraid to the point that they're not comfortable sharing it. But there is a compulsion that I think we spoke to just a minute ago. Woe is me if I don't share the gospel or preach the gospel. When we realize just how amazing it is that God has had mercy on us, beyond the knowledge aspect of that, there is a conviction that comes from that. And I think that's the other perspective. The more we understand how much Jesus values us, because of how much he valued a man like this, there's a conviction that comes from that that compels us to want to share that with other people who might struggle with those same questions about, am I valuable or does God love me? So let's get into the text and let's read beginning in verses 1 through 5. We'll get our introduction here. Verse 1, they came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him, and he had his dwelling among the tombs. And no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, night and day, he was screaming among the tombs and in the mountains, and gashing himself with stones. So stop right there for a minute. Just to set the scene here, Jesus has just come across the Sea of Galilee with his disciples, or with the apostles, in a boat, and they've been on the sea when there's this big storm that comes up. This is the time. It's not the time that Jesus walks on water. It's the time that he's asleep in the boat. And the disciples, the apostles are worried. So they wake him up. Master, don't you care that we're perishing? And then he gets up and he rebukes the wind and the waves and everything gets calm. But just imagine from the apostles' perspective, you're on the boat and you just went through that and saw that. And then you get to the shore. It's still early. And the first thing that happens, like you're literally bringing the boat onto the shore, getting out of the boat, and this dude comes running up to you from a distance, and he's screaming. That's the first thing you notice. And then as it gets a little bit closer, you're like, I'm pretty sure this dude isn't wearing any clothes. Mark doesn't say this, but Luke tells us he was naked, and he hadn't worn clothes for a long time. So here comes this naked, lunatic, crazy guy running up to the boat. I don't know how you would respond to that. I think my first reaction would be, I'm getting back in the boat and we're rowing back in the other direction as fast as we can. But that's what's going on here. Now, here's what I want to talk about, and I'll ask for your participation in this. Those first five verses give us a description of this man. And for a long time, when I heard this story, the people that I identified most with were Jesus and the apostles. That's who I would think about. Okay, what would it be like to be in their perspective or their shoes? What never occurred to me for the longest time was to think about this demoniac's perspective. And the more I thought about that, the more it was kind of an indictment on me. You know, like, I think that what that showed is that I was really more concerned about somebody coming into my life like that man who was going to be an inconvenience in some way. Then I was about thinking, what if I was in a need like that and I needed help, or I was in a situation like that. So I want you to think about in this scene what it'd be like to be in everybody's shoes and who you identify with most. But here's the question. What stands out to you about this man? Let's get to know him a little bit. In the first five verses, what are some of the details that you notice as we're reading that just kind of got your attention? No right or wrong answers here, but just in the first five verses.
Very strong.
Extremely strong. So strong that these shackles that he had been bound up with, no matter who put them on or how tight they were or whatever, he's tearing them apart. Now, how do you think about strength? Like, is strength a good thing, typically? Will we say so? Generally, I mean, yes, sir.
Yeah, not intruding on the conversation or the study, but an unclean spirit possessed this man.
Right.
So obviously, it's a supernatural strength beyond ourselves.
Yes.
It was beyond him to be able to do so, but because of his condition.
Good. So that's really key. This is something that comes from these demons, presumably. Good. And it makes him stronger than, you know, anybody we've ever seen. This is the kind of strength, it's like superhero strength, you know. Yes, sir.
The something that to me in reading it was that he didn't wait in the background and for Jesus to come to him. He immediately ran to Christ and said, "What have I got to do with you?"
Yes. Good. So
he was right there, and there was no denying it that this man was demon possessed.
Good. He runs to Jesus, but it's not like the kind of running to Jesus that's like, "Lord, help me." He doesn't want to have anything to do with them. And he realizes the difference there. So that's good. We'll come back to that. Let me just say this about strength really quickly. Whether you're talking about physical strength, emotional strength, mental strength, generally, we value that. You know, we want to be the kind of people who are strong enough to hold up under burdens and to make it through things, and not only to bear our burdens like we talked about last night, but to be able to help other people. And yet, for all of this man's strength, it had completely ruined him. Keep that in mind. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. What are some other things that stand out to you about this man? Anything else that you saw?
He was beyond recovery from men's help.
Okay, good. Yeah, there are going to be some things we're going to see, even in the way that he talks, where it's like, you're kind of wondering who's actually talking here, who's in control of the man. Very good. Yes, Eureka, did you have your hand up? Yes. I think that's exactly, that's the main point in thinking about all these descriptions of the man, is that this is who we are. Before we come to Jesus, without Jesus in our lives, this is what sin does to us. We'll come back to that, but that's a great observation. Yes, ma'am.
In verse 5, you know, he was always crying out and cutting himself. So he's destroying this himself.
Good.
This person made by God. So this demon is just really making him lash out.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, I mean, just imagine what, if you were this man, what your days would be like. Like, where does he live, by the way? In the tombs. Okay, so first thing is, your home is in a cemetery. That's where you live. I mean, just imagine if that's where you had to be, the kind of psychological toll that would take on you after a while. But if you're this man, here's what your days are like. You get up, you probably don't sleep much because you're kind of tormented and you're always talking to yourself and, you know, like yelling things out, cutting yourself. And there's so much there I don't claim to fully understand. I wonder, though, is that part of, are the demons causing that, or is this man trying to find a way to get rid of them? Like, is he thinking that maybe if I do this to my body, they'll leave me alone? I don't know. And it's very possible, maybe more probable is the demons. There's another case of demon possession where the demons would throw a child like into the fire. So it could be that. But in either case, your days are awful. I mean, this is what it's like to be in this man's shoes. Yes, sir.
Yeah, one thing I noticed, it says that they were so strong that they couldn't subdue him. But they're talking about the breaking chains. So they had to, at some point, subdue him and chain him up.
Yeah.
So to me, it's like a progression of getting stronger. And sometimes you see that in people, where they get
right.
Stronger and stronger. And sane. I mean, it's just that. At some point, they crack.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is awesome. But I just see that progression.
Good. So all these things you all have brought up, he lived among the tombs, often down with shackles and chains. No one was strong enough to subdue him, but that strength had ruined him. And then night and day, he's screaming and gashing himself with stones. Do you suppose, I mean, I don't know how long this man had been in this position, but do you think that maybe things hadn't always been this way? I wonder if, you know, if you're in his position, and this is your reality, anytime you come around somebody, the first thing that they want to do is to bind you up. You know, put chains and shackles on you. Just keep you away. Keep you from hurting anybody. I wonder if at some point this man was just like, I just want to be left alone. Was he living in the cemetery because at some point he just figured this is the only place I can go and be by myself and not have people just constantly trying to like just tie me up? That's speculation, but you wonder. And I think this is the kind of thing that helps us identify with this, with a man who otherwise would seem very distant from us. But I want to come back to what Eureka said. I don't know how well you identify with this man, but this should help us. Sin does the exact same things to us. It causes us to live among the dead. It causes us to be dead. It causes us to be shamefully naked. I mean, doesn't the Bible kind of talk about sin as nakedness? It causes us to be ruined, to suffer ruin in our relationships. So this is the reality for us. And I think that that's a big part of what we gather from this. You know, Jesus is always using physical examples to paint spiritual truths or portray spiritual truths. And I think that's part of the takeaway here is what Eureka pointed out, that this is all of us without Christ. And until He comes into our lives, we're living among the dead. Any strength that we have and we try to use is really kind of counterproductive, and it just ends up making things worse. So let's continue reading in verse 6, and let's read further. Verse 6, Jesus is going to start to engage with the man. Seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him, and shouting with a loud voice, he said, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me." For he had been saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And he was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he began to implore him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there was a large herd of swine feeding nearby on the mountain. The demons implored him, saying, "Send us into the swine so that we may enter them." Jesus gave them permission. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them. And they were drowned in the sea. We'll stop there for now. Now we talked about how strong this man was. It's remarkable, though, and I think you alluded to this, how for all of his strength, when he comes into the presence of Jesus and he meets him, he falls down and he begs him to leave. And it's almost like, I mean, he realizes that his strength, or the demons realize that their strength, is nothing compared to the strength of Jesus. And so for all that strength that he had, and I think this is the truth for us, you know, when we try to kind of figure out life on our own, no matter how strong we are, it does us no good spiritually. And that's where that left this man. Now, when you meet someone like this, what would you do? And maybe some of you have had interactions with people like this, and I don't mean demon-possessed people. I'm not talking about that. But just somebody who pretty quickly you feel like out of your element, out of your comfort zone, and you feel like this is a situation where I don't really know what to do, how to help this person. I don't even know what they need. I think there are a couple of reactions that we can have most often in situations like that. One is that we say something like, "Well, I just don't know, I don't feel equipped to know how to help this person, and so I can't really do anything." That's a challenge in and of itself. The other thing that can happen, though, and this is, I think, what's worse, is if we just kind of say, "Well, this person can't be helped at all. You know, it's not just an issue of me, it's really about them, and there's nothing that can be done." I think that's one of the things that's so instructive about Jesus, is it didn't matter who he was looking at, he never thought like that. There was never anybody that was so far gone that they could not be reached. You had a comment. I wanted to come back to you.
Well, again, I don't have a whole lot of thought, but it is interesting how, yes, there was unclean spirits at this time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There was also miraculous gifts given to be able to offset it, and Jesus always had all the power, always. What's incredible realistically today is, yes, we preach there is no more miraculous gifts given to any of us in Christ's kingdom. That was to usher in his church and to establish the church. But what's interesting is there's still messengers of Satan. Paul says, I had a thorn in my flesh.
Right.
Getting the word out. It was he tormented me day and night. So I think today that can happen. We can still
Absolutely.
We have that pressure. And this man at the tomb, at this point, he's desperate. And he has no answer for himself.
Right.
And what's awesome is, you had mentioned earlier, with the man always like this. I don't want to keep taking over the conversation.
No.
He was a boy at one time. And
yeah.
An innocent boy. You know what's incredible? And this is the perspective I believe Jesus had for people. Yes, we always talk about God creating man in his own image. We were all created in his image. Every human being, even the wickedest, ugliest person right now, hates people. We were innocent at one time. Wow. It just goes to show Jesus really is a friend of sinners.
Yes. Yeah, well said. And I appreciate your point about, you know, demon possession and miraculous gifts. I agree with that. But I also think you're right when you say if we make the assumption that, okay, just because they don't physically possess people today, it doesn't mean we have to be concerned about that. I think that's a mistake. Think about, just food for thought, when James is talking about wisdom from above versus wisdom that's from below, one of the words he used to describe that wisdom in James 3 is he says it's demonic wisdom. Paul warns Timothy in 1 Timothy 3, I'm not sure exactly, but he warns him about what he calls doctrines of demons. And it's in that text where he talks about people who forbid eating of certain foods and marriage, things like that. My point is that if Paul could say that things like that, which are still taught today, that those are things that come from demons, I mean, who are we to say that, well, we don't have to worry about any of that today? I think that the supernatural world is still just as active in very different ways. You know, not physical possession, but where do false ideas and where does false teaching come from? It's got to come from somewhere, and it doesn't come from God. So there's only one other option. It comes from the father of lies and from whatever forces, spiritual forces of wickedness are in alignment with him. So I think there's a lot of truth to that. We have to be careful about what we listen to. Not because we're going to be physically possessed by a demon today, I don't believe, but because those ideas can take hold of us in some very powerful ways. Now, we mentioned the fact that this man doesn't want to be healed. In this text that we read, here's where this weird conversation plays out. What's weird to me about it is, as you read, you kind of have to go back and look at the pronouns to figure out, like, who's even talking here? So in verse 10, or verse 9, when Jesus asks his name, and he said, the man said to Jesus, "My name is Legion, for we are many." So you read through that and it just kind of scratch your head, like, who is running the show here? Is the man in control? Is he talking? Are the demons making him talk? I don't really know. But here's kind of what I wonder if this is what part of what's going on, at least, is that there was an identity crisis in this man's life. For however long he'd been possessed by these demons, it had been going on so long that he'd kind of lost track of himself. Like, I don't know where I start or where I stop and the demons begin. Do you know anybody like that who they've kind of dealt with a similar thing because of the sin in their life? Here's what I mean by that. You talk to them about what God is doing, what God can do with them, and their response, and maybe even your response at some point has been, I believe that, and that's all great, but I just don't know if that's possible. Like, I've been wrapped up in this sin, for so long that I just don't even, I don't even know realistically if I can get out of it. And I think that that's a similar thing. It's an identity crisis where we lose sight of who we really are, that we are children of God, created in the image of God, and by the power of God, we can be restored to that image. So, one of the great things that Jesus teaches us is that He wasn't willing to let the demons define this man. And I think if we can take something away from this as we try to share the gospel with people, that's how we should think about sin. Sin is devastating, but it doesn't have to define people. And when we come across people who are like that, who have kind of accepted that, this is one of the most important things that they need to hear, is that sin doesn't define you. It might have shaped your life and a lot that's going on, but it doesn't have to define you. Yes, sir?
We also need to realize by this scripture, too, that sin, or in this case, demons, have their limits. They know their limits. Break down what he says even further. He says that the demons ask if they can leave.
Yes.
They're talking to the author of creation, Jesus. They needed his permission. They knew the power he had.
Right.
So we need to know that Jesus has that same power to come back to us and take care of the issues that we have.
Amen. Absolutely. Now, Jesus' approach is also instructive here. There is obviously compassion. I mean, he asks the man what his name is. I wonder how long it had been since somebody had asked that question. There's obvious compassion here, but he's also direct about this. And this is, I think, it helps us learn how to work with people as well. He doesn't ignore the problem. He doesn't come up to the man and make small talk and ask about the weather. How's the fishing on the beach? You know, like, none of that kind of stuff. And so when we're working with people, we have to try to find that same balance. We can be direct with people, or we need to be direct with people. We can't ignore the things that are going on or the problems that sin is causing and just act like everything's okay, because that doesn't help anybody. But at the same time, we can be so direct, and if it's not coupled with compassion, it's almost like the directness just turns into like a sledgehammer, you know? You just come and you're like beating on the person with the truth, and like, here's your sin, and you got to do something about it, and what are you doing about it? And sometimes if that's all somebody's hearing, then it's just easy to feel lost and hopeless, which is where the compassion comes in. Jesus makes it clear that he cares. So I think we have to strike the balance between both of them. Directness without compassion is harmful, but compassion without directness only enables, and it doesn't really help things. Yes, sir?
You can have compassion without love.
Okay.
And so the directness coupled with compassion and love,
okay,
makes the thought, to me, complete.
Good.
Because if we don't love the person's soul, we do not have the ability to have a love for all men, then our compassion is another way of saying sympathy.
Okay. Good. Yeah, so maybe love is the thing that moves us from just compassion to action. I mean, Paul talked about that in 2 Corinthians 5. The love of Christ compels us. So, very good. Now, we're going to read the rest of this text and make our way, talk about some applications of this. We're going to see this man being completely transformed in just a few moments, which is remarkable. And I think that by the grace and power of God, this is a text that reminds us that sometimes in people's lives, people can be transformed in similar ways. I mean, you know, you've probably met people like this. It's like once they make up their mind that they're going to follow Christ and he's going to take over the throne in their heart, it's like night and day. It's like the light switch gets flipped. But not everybody's like that. And I think that this is also a helpful reminder that that change doesn't occur as quickly for everyone. And so if we want to be helpful and we want to be equipped to be to serve and to point people to Jesus in the same ways, a big part of what allows us to do this is to have patience with this process. To always believe that by the power of Jesus, this transformation is possible. But and to never underestimate God's ability to do that. But to not give up on people if it doesn't happen that way. You know, to still be patient with people if the process is more gradual. Okay, let's read the rest of the text, continuing in verse 14. Verse 14 says, "Their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and in the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed in his right mind, the very man who had the legion, and they became frightened. Those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine. And they began to implore him to leave their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him, and he did not let him. But he said to him, 'Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you.' And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed." All right. We're coming up kind of close on time. So I'll probably have to move through these quickly and maybe not take as many comments, but we'll see. So, one of the things to point out about this, there's an interesting word that happens here. Do you notice the word implore? I'm reading the New American Standard. Your version might read differently, but the word implore shows up quite a few times in this text, or asked or begged or whatever, same Greek word. But it shows up at least five times, and three of those times it comes from the man. Two times it comes from other sources. So I want to walk you through these. Verse 12. The demons implored him, saying, "Send us into the swine so that we may enter them." So the demons implore in verse 12, and Jesus grants their request, right? Sends them into the swine. Verse 17, the townspeople, and they began to implore him to leave their region. So the people who see all this happen, they beg him and say, "Please just leave us alone." And Jesus grants their request. Three times the man implores Jesus to do something. First time is verse 7. The man shouts with a loud voice, "What business do we have to do with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me." Leave me alone, basically. Second time is verse 10. He implores Jesus not to send the demons out of the country. And then verse 18, he implores Jesus to follow him, to let me follow you. So the demons implore Jesus, and he says, he gives them what they ask. The townspeople implore Jesus, he gives them what they ask. But three times the man implores Jesus, and all three times, guess what? He doesn't give them what he asked for. It's kind of shocking on the surface, so look at that. But I think here's part of what we learn from this. Why did Jesus not do that? It shows us that God cares more about giving us purpose than about giving us what we want. And this is so important. I mean, if you've ever prayed a prayer to God, thinking this is from the heart, this is what I really need right now, it's what I think is best, and the answer to that was no, or it wasn't what you wanted it to be. This is kind of the thing we wrestle with, right? Is why does God do things the way that he does? But I think this is a great reminder to us that sometimes the reason, even when we beg God for certain things, that he doesn't grant those requests is because there is purpose that he has. And maybe we don't know about it. But in the case of the man, he finds out what it is. Maybe we don't always see that. But God cares more about giving us purpose than about giving us what we want. Another thing that Jesus tells the man is he tells him to go home to your people. Instead of following Jesus, he says, no, you go home and you go to your people. When you think about that, anyone here want to do great things for the Lord? Like, you want to serve him and be active and just whatever you have to offer, you want that to be God's. Sometimes when people first become Christians, there's like this enthusiasm that they have, and it's just like, send me wherever, God. You know, like I'll talk to the president, I'll talk to whoever. You send me across an ocean, and I'll do it, and I'll go. It's interesting that here's a man who was willing to do that and follow Jesus wherever. There were a lot of people that weren't willing to do that. Rich young ruler was one of them. And yet what Jesus tells this man is, I want you to go home. And I want you to go to your people. If we want to do great things for the Lord, I think where that starts for us is it starts with those closest to us. I've got some friends who preach overseas, and some of the advice that they were given when they first started preaching was, you go and preach at home before you go and preach in Rome. And the idea was, if you want to be ready and equipped for the kinds of things you're going to deal with in a far off place, you gotta learn that first close to home. If you can't learn to talk to the people closest to you in your life, it's not going to get any easier just because you're talking to strangers. So I think this is good news for us, even though sometimes it's hardest to talk to people that we love about our faith when maybe they don't share that. But I think this is an important starting point. That there are people in our lives right away that we can try to help. And maybe all that is we're just around them and we're living a different life, like this guy was. His life is completely transformed. He's in his right mind. And that's where his example started in Decapolis. But the next thing that's great here is what Jesus tells him to do. If you've ever wondered, what do I tell people? You know, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to give a wrong answer. Jesus' counsel to this man is, you tell them what great things the Lord has done for you. He doesn't tell the man to go and explain to them all the nuances of the law. He doesn't tell him you gotta discuss Hebrew poetry and chiasm in the Psalms and all this crazy stuff. He tells him, you just go tell these people what God's done for you. And if you have ever wrestled with that, with thinking you don't know much, what do you think this man knew? Maybe before he was demon possessed, he went to seminary and he's trained to be a scribe or whatever. But I don't think so. But that wasn't what he had to talk about. And the reality for us is, if you've been in that place where you are a slave of sin, and God has set you free, then He has done great things for you. And if God has done great things for you in your life, that's all you have to talk about. I'm serious. I mean, and I'm not saying that biblical literacy is unimportant. Don't get me wrong. But the point is that some of the most important starting places are, especially for people who knew what we were like, or who are what we used to be, one of the most helpful things that they can hear before we ever quote a scripture to them or study a chapter of the Bible is just to know that there's somebody that by the grace of God is now in a different place, and to see the power of that example. A couple other things I want to talk about, and we'll have to hit these quickly, but one thing here is that Jesus doesn't get to pick this man. Sometimes Jesus picks his disciples and chooses who he asks to follow him, but we don't always get to choose the people that God wants us to work with. And our job is to simply value people enough that if somebody comes across our path, no matter how much we feel like them or how similar they are or how different they are, doesn't matter what the circumstances are, we know that they're created in God's image. And we value them enough to look past all of the differences and the window dressings and just try to get to know them, hear their story, and try to offer truth in their lives. So this man goes away and he does what Jesus calls him to do. He proclaims, he begins to proclaim, and the response is that everyone is amazed. One of the great things about this is that Jesus can't stay here because people don't want him to. He leaves Decapolis, but he's not done in Decapolis. He's going to come back a few chapters later in Mark. What's amazing is that when he comes back, it tells us that people were coming from all over Decapolis to listen to him. How? I mean, these are the same people that before they were like, please leave us alone. You're obviously a big deal, but we can't handle you being here. What do you think changed that? You think it's possible that this formerly demon-possessed man, in going around and telling people how great the things were that God did for him, that's what changed when Jesus came back? And so you had a group of people who wouldn't respond directly to Jesus, but they would listen to this man. So this man, God gave him a messenger in his darkest hour. That messenger helped change his life. And then that messenger gave him a message, similar message, and said, you go and you share that to other people. You ever had a messenger like that in your life? Like when you were kind of at your lowest point or in your darkest hour, there's somebody who came along and told you something that helped you. How much is that worth to you? How thankful are you to that person? Thankful enough to tell them that you appreciate what they've done for you? Thankful enough to be that same kind of messenger for somebody else who's in a dark place? Last thing I want to consider with you this morning is just to try to answer the question, how much was one soul worth to Jesus? For starters, he was worth a dangerous trip across a stormy lake. He was worth the loss of a lot of pigs, which sounds kind of funny, but that's income, that's the economy for a whole region. This man was more important than that. One soul was worth the embarrassment of being run out of town. One soul was worth having a new relationship with one more disciple who had all kinds of baggage and past history and things that would have been challenging. But all of that was worth, one soul was worth all that to Jesus. So the question for us as we try to overcome our fears in reaching people and sharing people with the gospel is, how much is one soul worth to you? I know we didn't leave time for questions, so mission accomplished. No, I really would love, if you have other things you want to say, I'd love to hear from you. I know that you guys see great things in this text that I'm sure I missed, but if you have questions or comments, come and talk to me. But thank you so much for your good participation and your attention. We'll take a break.